Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 17th of April. Coming up on the program, welcome news as consumer inflation slows. A new Gauteng government Takealot partnership, but there are safety concerns that are being raised around the online retailer. The impact of Chinese online retailers on the South African market. Can artisanal mining be incorporated into the formal sector? And how worried should we be about an increasing reptile extinction in South Africa? The Gauteng Premier Panyaza Losufi and his Economic Development MEC are set to launch the Takealot Township Economy Initiative. It's been described by the government as a game-changing partnership between the provincial authority and the country's largest e-commerce company. The MEC is Tasneem Motara, who joins us now on MoneyWeb at Midday. MEC, a very warm welcome to you. And what's the purpose then of this partnership? What are you hoping to achieve?
Thanks so much, Jeremy. Well, I think importantly, it's just a platform for us to be able to partner with the private sector in relation to opportunities for local suppliers, local manufacturers, local retailers, also to be able to take up the opportunity in the e-commerce environment. Takealot is a South African company. It's the biggest e-commerce company that we have in South Africa. But there are a lot of local products, local retailers, local businesses that have not yet had an opportunity to access their service. And this is through this partnership what we seek to achieve.
So MEC, it sounds very good on paper, but maybe you could provide specific examples of how this initiative, this plan, is going to open up market access, particularly for small businesses who often lack the skills in terms of marketing and the ability to penetrate.
So Takealot has got about 7 programs that we are participating in. So for an example, there is the restaurant, the Trailblazer restaurant program. That is the delivery of restaurant food products. If you are familiar with the Mr. D, Mr. Delivery concept, or Mr. Delivery itself. So this will allow especially township restaurateurs and locally produced food spaces to access their platform, be onboarded onto their platform. They will also get business support throughout the process. There's another program that the Takealot team has. It's the delivery team driver development program. Mm. So that is the one that we're most familiar with, the guys on the bikes that deliver your stock. So essentially the model is that it's you own your own business. So depending on the amount of deliveries you make in a day, that's the kind of income you generate for yourself. But the program does have SMME support aspects to it. So they'll be trained, they'll be given skills and knowledge on how to run a business, just the principles of entrepreneurship and business.
MEC, you will agree with me, MEC, that this entire model, though, is predicated on competitive price and quality. How's that going to be monitored?
Yes, definitely. So that's one of the aspects that's one of the positives that being on the platform will give you as a business. You'll be able to use that data to, for instance, work out what specials you could have if you were a restaurateur. What products, what dishes serve better and well on which days for which clientele. Also being uploaded or onboarded onto their platform, they will also give you the support in terms of competitive pricing. Quality is something that we are looking at with them. So, you know, usually a review process will give an indicator to a buyer of the type of quality that you're buying. But it's really going to open up places an opportunity for somebody who would otherwise be a very small retailer, small manufacturer with a limited clientele, to be able to access many more buyers because of the e-commerce platform.
MEC, let me suggest that you probably couldn't be launching an initiative like this at a more difficult time. You are obviously aware of the aggressive penetration of at least two Chinese online retail platforms that could potentially upset the strategy.
No, definitely. It's one of the things that we did look at, and without, of course, mentioning their names, the Chinese platforms. We have looked at it with the Takealot Group. Part of it has got to do with policy formulation, which we are working on together with the National Department of Trade Industry, the DTIC. They have to finalize that policy that will disallow cheap imports into the country through the tax regime, etc. Also, we don't have, as South African businesses and retailers and restaurants, we don't have an opportunity to have our products onboarded onto those Chinese platforms. If you're looking for proudly South African products, you'll only be able to find it on a platform such as Takealot.
I'm going to leave it there. Tasneem Motada, thank you very much indeed, the Economic Development MEC here in the province of Gauteng.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Department of Mineral Resources and Energy is re-looking its licensing rules to make it more easy for artisanal mining to operate legally, should I say. You will be aware that illegal mining has cost the economy something in the region of 70 billion rand a year. So how is all of this going to play out? Makasonki Buthelezi is with me now, who speaks for the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy. So how then is the department, and welcome to you, thanks for joining us, how is the department planning to address the specific challenges that are faced by these miners under the current licensing rules? What's going to change?
Thanks for the opportunity, Jeremy. So what currently is happening is that under the current Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, artisanal and small-scale mining are treated the same as large-scale miners, with environmental or water use, health and safety, and financial provisioning requirements. And they have to basically follow the same rules when it comes to applying for mining permits, which are cumbersome and very costly. So what we have done is we currently have an approved policy, which was approved in 2022, which basically is forming the basis for the artisanal and small mining legal framework. And in that policy, we are proposing that there should be tailor-made licenses for artisanal and small-scale mining, that don't require all these onerous things that are placed on them currently.
All right, that sounds very positive. You're going to speed up the process. You're going to do away with the red tape. But how are you going to decide specifically on who gets the license? How will the process be vetted?
So who's going to get the license is basically people who are South African, who are South Africans, residents of South Africa, and it's those who are entering into the mining sector for the first time, its first entrance, and it's those who are currently involved already in the artisanal and small-scale mining, but they need a license. And mostly we are biased towards those who are involved with mining industrial minerals, surface mining. But what is mostly important and will be biased towards youth and women-owned mines. But what is very important when it comes is that they must be South Africans.
Surely the bigger problem that your department has got to resolve is stopping illegal mining.
Yes, and that is why we are introducing this. We have the policy in place. And what we need to be very careful of is make a clear distinction. There is illegal mining. Everybody who mines without a license, that is illegal. You have somebody who's mining sand, and they are not aware that they need a license, and they are mining illegally because they are not authorized. So you go to that person, you take them through the process, and this policy is designed to assist them. We even have funding for such people. Then you have the other group that is also involved in illegal mining, but they in character, you know, we view them as engaged in criminal activity simply because they are associated with organized crime. That's the first thing.
And Mr. Buthelezi, that I know exactly what they are, and that's exactly the reason why I've raised this issue with you. Okay. That's your biggest problem, is to try and get rid of the so-called Zama-Zamas. Surely that's where your focus should be on right now.
It is, but we must be careful, because then it will be as if we are legalizing what they are doing, those criminals. Look, if they want to participate and they want government to assist them, they need to register formally with CIPC, have a company, and once they are registered, then we recognize them as small businesses, small artisanal miners, then government can be able to assist them.
You're not telling me that you expect these Zama-Zamas to register mines, are you, and approach the department and look for a license?
That is why we look them. We look particularly those, because like I said, Jeremy, all of them fall under the umbrella of Zama-Zamas. Zama-Zamas is somebody who is hustling, and all of them are hustling. So those that are currently doing illegal mining activities that are associated with criminality, particularly in areas that we know in Gauteng, and even if we wanted to approach them, Jeremy, with the programs that we have, they will shoot us on sight. Because we can go and approach them and say, come guys, let's formalize you. I don't think they are amenable to that. But we are.
All right, I understand the differentiation. How are you going to convince the non-criminal miners to approach you and seek the licensing conditions that you're proposing? What's your strategy in that respect?
Yes, what we are currently doing is we will be going out. Firstly, we've already actually advertised the artisanal and small-scale mining fund that we have, and we received an overwhelming number of applications. We issued an advert in January. We received up to 1,000 applications. We have done our shortlisting, which shows that there are those who are keen on doing things like that. But
how many are on that shortlist?
There are 21, because our target was 13 due to financial constraints. But we've stretched it to 21, and we are going to issue a so-called window, I think, after June. So we are going to reach out to them. We are going to have provincial workshops where we will invite them, and then so that they can know about the program.
But I assume that they're going to have to demonstrate to you their ability to adhere to safety regulations, and they have got to be adequately funded.
That is true, and we can, and through these interactions that we're going to have, we will be able to also get feedback on some of the things that we have, of the processes that are sort of standing their way to being able to fully participate as artisanal and small scale miners. And we're working through. We also have their organizations that represent them, that we are working with them, who are assisting us to identify them in the provinces. So we'll be working with them throughout the country all, right. all these workshops that we'll be having.
All right. Thank you very much indeed for the explanation. Speaking for the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, that is Makasonki Buthelezi.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Annual consumer price inflation slowing for the first time this year, dropping to 5.3% in March. That's down from 5.6%. The decline driven by food and non-alcoholic beverage prices decelerating. And here are the percentages, 5.1% in March from 6.1% in February, and way down from the peak of 14%, can you remember, in March last year. All of that coming from Stats SA a little earlier today. Let's try and unravel all of this. Dr. Azar Jameen is with us, Chief Economist at Econometrics. Azar, welcome to you. So what factors, in your opinion, have contributed to the deceleration in the prices of food and non-alcoholic beverages, particularly on the food side where there has been worry?
Jeremy, you've got to bear in mind that inflation is a measure of year-on-year change in prices. Now, last year we had a fairly dramatic increase in the prices of a number of goods, including poultry and milk, egg and cheese, as a result of bird flu. And we've also seen, obviously, some of the effects of the drought starting to emerge. But the point is that in relation to the rate of increase that we were seeing this time last year, even though prices are still accelerating, they are doing so at a much slower rate. We are fearful that the full effects of the drought, especially in pushing up maize prices by around 35% in the past couple of months, will indeed eventually filter through and cause the food inflation rate to reverse and start rising a little. But it's a case of comparing against a very high rate of increase a year ago, so that even though prices are increasing, still they're not doing so anywhere near as fast as a year ago. Having said that, I think the extent of the decline in the food inflation rate has taken people by surprise.
So what I'm also hearing you say, Azar Jameen, is that this is not necessarily sustainable and that it's probably short-lived.
We fear so in respect of the food side. In respect of the rest of the economy, excluding food and fuel, which are almost beyond our control, we have seen a slight decrease in the inflation rate, the so-called core inflation rate, and to some extent that is encouraging, down from 5.0 to 4.9%.
All right. So, Azar, given the current inflation rate and the explanation, how does this then compare with the Reserve Bank's target rate, and what implications might this have for future monetary policy?
I think it's fairly encouraging that the Reserve Bank's forecast of inflation eventually falling below 5% later this year and declining to close to its 4.5% inflation midpoint of the inflation target, which is what it really targets, by the end of next year. I think these latest figures say we're on course to meet that. And that in turn is encouraging because it suggests that at some stage we may get a little bit of interest rate relief, but not quite yet, because 5.3% is still way above 4.5% that the Reserve Bank is really targeting.
And Azar, all of this, of course, affected by exogenous factors like the situation in the Middle East and whether or not we will get a decision on a rates cut by the Federal Reserve in the United States.
Absolutely correct. If oil prices should rise further as a result of geopolitical factors, then some of our optimism has to be totally discarded. Conversely, if things settle down geopolitically, we could see oil prices dropping back quite a lot again and fuel prices starting to come down, and we could get down to that 4.5% target a lot sooner. But you're quite right, the Reserve Bank does, of course, have one of its eyes firmly looking at what is happening to interest rates overseas. And there the position is that, especially in the US, the economy has been much stronger than had been expected. And as a result, people are asking why they should rush ahead to cut interest rates anytime soon. And the expectation of the first interest rate cuts overseas has been pushed out to September or later, certainly in the US. Europe may come, cuts may come a little sooner because the Eurozone economy is very weak.
Dr. Azar Jamin from Econometrics, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I want to return now to online trading. And has Amazon's South African launch later this year posed anything of a dilemma for local retailers who are now contending with Chinese retail giants like Shein and Temu, which are advertising intensively, you would have seen that, and flooding the market with highly competitive offerings? Gerard Janse van Vuren is an equity analyst at Flagship Asset Management, and he has a view on this new retail war. Gerard, a very warm welcome to you. So what are we in store for?
I think, Jeremy, we're in store for increased competition. I think that is going to lead to possibly even job losses in South Africa. And I think the risk is that we need to carefully think about, from a regulatory perspective, what our approach should be. There's a one argument is very capitalistic, saying, well, we should specialize in what we can do the most efficiently. And if retail, we can't do it as efficiently yet, then we should allow these companies to enter our markets. But I think the more middle of the road approach would be to actually think clearly about what policies we should implement to combat or at least just balance out the competition in the sector.
Gerard, can you make the link between the entrance into the market by these players and where the job losses might come?
I think the main point where job losses might come is where there might be lower demand for our retail products, which I mean, directly that will impact our retailers and their warehouses and all up and down the value chain for them, which will likely lead to job losses.
What kind of strategies then do you think that retailers need to be thinking about, need to be adopting to maintain their market share? Because as you rightly point out, these big players are now firmly in their rearview mirror.
Yeah, I think the best approach for local retailers would be to focus on building that relationship with their customers to retain loyalty, even though you can't offer the best price, but you can offer the best service and you can perhaps know some of your customers by name or offer them good experience when they go to your stores. I think that's probably the best approach you can take.
Gerard, I don't need to tell you, though, that in tough times like this, doesn't price always trump loyalty and service?
I think price is a major speaking point. I think for a lot of consumers, especially in South Africa, as I mentioned, it is difficult to compete on other things except price because consumers are looking to save that extra few rands that they can. And price is the big, customers speak with their wallets.
So what sort of regulatory measures then, as you mentioned earlier, do we need to start considering to ensure a degree of fair competition between local retailers and international e-commerce giants without shutting the big players out of this market completely?
I think we do already have some tariffs on, like, for example, imported clothing and items. I think the concerns for retailers in South Africa is not necessarily the competition. I think the concern is that these guys are sidestepping the rules by importing it in smaller batches where, as I understand, then you could sidestep these rules. And I think that for them is the major concern because that makes the playing field unlevel. And I think that is where they are quite worried about the situation.
And given volumes, though, or expected volumes at least, this is going to be a very difficult area, surely, to regulate, to monitor and police.
Yes, it will be very difficult and it will take a lot of effort from our regulatory agencies to think about the best policy forward because you also can't just go into the market and implement something if you haven't weighed up the cost versus the benefit of the regulation.
I'm wondering if the regulatory agencies themselves have applied or are starting to apply their mind to this particular issue. The sense is if we don't act quickly, we're just going to fall further and further behind the curve. And again, that will have the negative impact, as you've suggested, on local retailers and particularly the ones that can least absorb it, the smaller players in the space.
Yes. Just anecdotally speaking to a few people with smaller businesses, it is quite clear that they are feeling the impact. Someone mentioned that their business that's doing a few hundred thousand rand a month has gone to half of that within a few months after the entrance of Temu and Shein. So it is quite worrying seeing it on the ground and seeing what the actual effects are.
It's not just going to be the smaller retailers, but it's going to be the other platforms like Takealot, for instance.
Yes, Takealot itself, I mean, they reported a while back that they're still loss-making, and I think for them, the added pressure of something like a Temu and Shein, I think that will just add to their worries, and they will really have to think hard about what their strategy will be going forward.
And Gerard, if you look at the significant spend, particularly by Temu on advertising platforms like Meta and Google, it's quite astonishing. You cannot scroll through a feed these days without seeing something. How significant, in your opinion, then, is the role of this hyper-aggressive digital marketing in shaping consumer preferences in this country? In many respects, they're almost wearing us down, aren't they?
Yeah, it does feel like they're weighing us down. And I think something that I noticed is that the aggressive spend, we're really talking about you can't avoid it. And in an age where you're fighting for even 1 second of attention from your consumers, aggressive marketing where your customers might see your ad a few times a day, that is quite powerful. And I think we're seeing the effects of that.
We certainly are. Gerard Jansen van Vuren, thank you very much indeed. Equity analyst at Flagship Asset Management. I appreciate those thoughts. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, a new global review has found that more than 20% of reptile species are in decline and at a risk of extinction. More now from Graham Alexander. He's Professor of Herpetology, Environmental Ecology and Evolution at the University of the Witwatersrand. Professor, warm welcome to you. So species like tortoises, crocodiles, chameleons, vipers, particularly vulnerable to extinction in Africa. Why is that?
So there are several reasons, Jeremy. One of the growing threats that we have for reptiles is the pet trade. People are legally harvesting them from the wild and smuggling them and exporting them. And because a lot of these species that have got high values have also got really small distributions, you know, harvesting them from the wild can have a big impact on the population size in the wild. And so that's one of them. But obviously, habitat transformation or degradation and climate change are all having an impact as well. And unfortunately, you know, with reptiles, because a lot of them are fairly cryptic, you don't easily see them, and they're not as charismatic as sort of, you know, the big mammals and so on. They don't get the same sort of research that the larger animals get for conservation. And so often they just overlooked and neglected.
So, Professor, as far as the pet trade is concerned, I'm assuming that it's difficult to stop, one, but two, it's also very lucrative, isn't it?
I think it is. You know, if we look globally at the wildlife trade, I think it's been listed as the third most lucrative illegal trade after drugs and weapons. So, I mean, it's in the billions of dollars. And although obviously what's going on in South Africa is a very much smaller scale, but there are several species in the groups that you listed that have got high value. For example, the small vipers in parts of Europe and so on, there's never been any export permits issued to legally take them out of the country, and yet, you know, collectors are breeding them there. So we don't really know how big the illegal trade is, really, to be honest with you, but we do know that it's happening. It's obviously very difficult to measure because, you know, the very nature of it's happening in a sort of secretive way.
So I guess that begs the question then, how effective are existing conservation measures in protecting these species? And I'm sure that you've got some suggestions on where there is room for improvement.
Absolutely. So, for example, often if a person gets an export permit, one of the requirements is that the animals that are exported are captive bred and not illegally harvested from the wild. And obviously, you know, it's very difficult to tell if the specimens that are going out are actually captive bred. And so people launder them, and we need the tools to now to be able to go and measure. And so we are starting to use genetics in this way so that we can go and sequence parts of the genes and so on and tell whether the parents of a particular animal are the other animals that the keeper has got. So we can test for paternity and maternity of the individuals. So that allows us to sort of up the sort of standard of how we are checking to see that it's not a legal trade.
Is this an issue for policymakers? And if so, are we failing in that respect?
So, Jeremy, I think that we're getting better at it. But, you know, as I said, the illegal type of trade that's happening sort of under the radar, we don't really know how big it is. We've got some ideas with certain species where we see them crop up for sale on the internet, and we're using other methods as well. But from a policy point of view, you know, as a researcher who is aimed mainly at fighting for the conservation of these animals, I think that the permitting system has more of an impact on us because, you know, we can't go and do these sort of research projects illegally if we're going to be publishing them in the scientific literature. So we have to declare this is our permit number and that. So it's very easy for the authorities to make sure that we're not breaking the rules. But if you're a smuggler, you don't have to, you know, play the game in, you know, such an honest way. So I think that the legislation should actually be tuned so that it's pro-conservation rather than just sort of being red tape. I mean, it's one of my gripes, to be honest with you. So, yeah.
I appreciate the conversation. Graham Alexander from Wits University, thank you indeed. And just before we go, on our online poll yesterday, the firing of the NSFAS board, I asked if it was a positive move, if it would make any difference at all, or if it was just simply going to be more stress on students. Well over half of our respondents say the change is immaterial. And today, you heard me talking a little earlier about a new partnership between the Gauteng government and the online trading platform Takealot. We'd like to know if you use the online retailer. No, I've never tried it, or I worry about safe delivery. If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X or our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.